A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
A single freight train can replace 300 trucks on the highway. And yet, in most of the world, most overland freight still moves by truck. So Daniel sent us this one. He's asking how important rail freight actually is in today's global logistics picture, what the real modal split looks like between truck and rail for overland routes, and what drives the decision for logistics operators choosing between them. There's a lot of tension here between rail's theoretical efficiency and its real-world friction.
That tension is exactly where this gets interesting. Let's start with the numbers, because the global variation is wild. In the United States, rail carries about 7-8% of freight ton kilometers. The EU sits around 18%. China and Russia are up near 50%. Same planet, same basic physics. Steel wheel on steel rail is always more efficient than rubber on asphalt, but completely different outcomes.
What's actually producing that spread? Is it just infrastructure spending, or is something deeper going on?
It's three things layered on top of each other. Infrastructure, obviously. China has poured $1.2 trillion into rail infrastructure since 2010, much of it freight corridor specific. But underneath that, you've got geography and industrial structure. Russia moves enormous quantities of bulk commodities over vast distances, coal, ore, timber, and those are exactly the cargoes rail was born to carry. The US has a similar bulk commodity backbone. Europe has a lot more manufactured goods moving shorter distances between dense urban clusters, which favors truck.
The modal split isn't really a policy choice, so much as a reflection of what a country's economy physically looks like.
But policy is a huge lever. The EU has an explicit target of 30% rail freight share by 2030 under the Green Deal. They're not going to hit it. They're stuck at 18, and the trend line is basically flat, but the fact that they set the target tells you it's a political priority. The US has never set a modal shift target for freight. It's been market-driven, for better or worse.
The market, left to its own devices, chose trucks.
The market chose trucks for most things, and rail for the things only rail can do. Which brings us to the economics, because this is where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. The fundamental fact is that rail is 3-4 times more fuel efficient than truck per ton mile. The US Department of Energy pegs rail at about 450 ton miles per gallon versus truck at about 130. That's a massive efficiency gap. But fuel is only one line item.
Right, because the train doesn't back up to the loading dock.
And this is the thing most people miss when they look at the raw efficiency numbers. Rail requires transshipment at both ends, the first mile and the last mile. Your cargo gets trucked from the origin to a rail terminal, loaded onto a train, moved hundreds or thousands of miles, unloaded at another terminal, and trucked to the final destination. That drayage at both ends adds 1-2 days and 15-25% to the total cost for most shipments under 500 miles.
There's a break-even distance where rail's line haul efficiency finally overcomes the drayage penalty.
That distance is roughly 500 miles. Below 500 miles, truck almost always wins on total door-to-door cost and transit time. Between 500 and 1500 miles, rail becomes competitive, especially for heavier cargo. Above 1500 miles, rail has a clear cost advantage, but only if the route actually exists.
Which is a bigger if than people realize.
So let's make this concrete. Imagine a shipment of auto parts from Detroit to Dallas, about 1,100 miles. By truck, that's 2 days door-to-door at roughly $2.50 per mile. By rail, you're looking at 4 to 5 days at about $1.20 per mile for the line haul, but then you add drayage trucking at both ends, another $400 to $600 total. Your net savings come out around 30%, but your transit time more than doubles.
The logistics operator is making a judgment call. Is his cargo time sensitive enough that the savings aren't worth the delay?
That judgment depends entirely on what's in the container. Auto parts are a great example because they sit right on the boundary. If it's a just-in-time supply chain feeding an assembly line, you pay the truck premium every time. A line shutdown costs far more than the freight savings. If it's replenishment stock for a parts warehouse, rail makes perfect sense.
How does that actually play out in practice, day to day? Who's making that call, and what does the conversation sound like?
Usually, it's a logistics manager staring at a screen at 7 in the morning with a coffee that's gone cold. They've got a purchase order for 12 pallets of brake calipers that need to be at the plant by Thursday. The truck quote is $4,200 and guarantees Thursday delivery. The rail quote is $2,900, but the intermodal ramp is 40 miles from the plant. The train schedule means it arrives Wednesday, or maybe Friday if there's a delay in Chicago, and then you still need a drayage carrier with availability. The logistics manager has been burned twice this quarter on rail delays. They click approve on the truck quote and move on to the next problem.
The theoretical 30% savings evaporates against the reality of, I cannot be the person who shut down the assembly line.
And that's why rail's market share for manufactured goods keeps slipping. The cost savings are real on a spreadsheet, but the career risk of a missed delivery is also real, and spreadsheets don't capture that.
Then there's the stuff where there's no decision to make at all.
Coal from Wyoming's Powder River Basin to a power plant in Georgia. 1,800 miles. Unit trains of 120-plus cars, no transshipment, straight from mine to plant. Rail cost is roughly 3 cents per ton mile. Truck would be about 15 cents per ton mile. There is no trucking option. It would be economic suicide. That's why bulk commodities make up 60 to 70% of U.S. rail tonnage. Coal, grain, ore, chemicals, petroleum products. These are heavy, low value per pound, predictable flows. Rail was designed for them.
The U.S. rail network was built around exactly those flows. The Class I railroads, BNSF, Union Pacific, Norfolk Southern, CSX, they're private companies running private infrastructure optimized for long-haul bulk.
Which is both a strength and a weakness. The U.S. has about 140,000 route miles of rail, down from 254,000 in 1916. 70% of it is single track. That means when something goes wrong. A derailment, a crew timeout, a signal failure. You can't just route around it. The whole line stops.
East Palestine in 2023 was the dramatic version of that. But I imagine the day-to-day congestion is the real story.
The day-to-day is where the capacity constraint bites. The U.S. rail network is, by global standards, underinvested and over-optimized for a narrow set of cargo types. The Class I railroads have been enormously profitable running this model. Operating ratios in the low 60s, meaning they keep 35 to 40 cents of every revenue dollar as profit. But that profitability came from focusing on the most efficient lanes and cargoes and shedding everything else.
Which brings us to precision scheduled railroading.
The operating philosophy that reshaped North American rail starting around 2018. The idea is simple. Run fewer, longer trains on fixed schedules, minimize yard time, maximize asset utilization. And it worked, by the metrics that matter to shareholders. Asset velocity improved 25%. Operating ratios dropped. Stock prices went up.
The shippers hated it.
Some of them still do. Because PSR means the railroad runs trains when it's efficient for the railroad, not when the shipper wants their cargo moved. On-time performance for some shippers dropped 10 to 15 percentage points. If you're a grain elevator in Kansas and the train shows up 2 days late during harvest, that's a real problem. Some cargo shifted to truck not because truck was cheaper, but because truck was reliable.
The railroad optimized itself into losing business.
It optimized itself into being very profitable at a smaller set of services. Whether that's a good long-term strategy is an open question, but it highlights something important. Modal choice isn't just about cost per ton mile. It's about reliability, frequency, and whether the service actually exists for your lane.
Let's talk about Europe, because the picture there is completely different.
Fragmented is the word. The EU has national rail networks built by individual states over a century and a half, with different electrification standards, different signaling systems, different loading gauges, and in some cases, looking at you, Spain and Portugal, different track gauges entirely. A train crossing from Germany into France needs to switch locomotives or use multi-system units. Crossing from Poland into Belarus, you're dealing with a gauge break where they literally lift the cars and swap the bogies.
Wait, literally lift the cars? How does that even work?
It's called a gauge changing facility, and it's exactly as slow as it sounds. The train pulls into a shed. Hydraulic jacks lift each car, or sometimes the entire train set. The old bogies are rolled out, new bogies of the correct gauge are rolled in, and the car is lowered onto them. The process takes hours for a full freight train. There are some variable gauge systems that can shift wheel spacing on the fly at low speed. Spain's Talgo system is the best known, but those are passenger-focused and not widely deployed for heavy freight.
Every border crossing is a multi-hour production,
which adds time and cost at every border. The EU has been trying to harmonize this for decades with limited success. The Rail Freight Corridors Initiative was supposed to create seamless cross-border paths, and it's helped, but the fundamental problem is that national infrastructure was designed for national priorities. France built its rail network radiating from Paris. Germany built a polycentric network connecting multiple industrial regions. They don't connect to each other elegantly.
A shipment from Barcelona to Berlin has to navigate two gauge changes, multiple signaling systems, and at least one locomotive swap.
Each of those transitions is a point where the shipment can sit for 12 hours waiting for a crew, a slot, or paperwork clearance. The average speed of a cross-border freight train in the EU is about 18 kilometers per hour when you factor in all the dwell time. A truck on the same route averages 60 plus.
Yet the EU wants 30% rail share.
Driven by the emissions trading system extension to transport and the broader decarbonization push. And the logic is sound. Rail produces about 75% fewer CO2 emissions per ton mile than truck. But here's the catch. That advantage depends heavily on electrification. About 60% of EU rail is electrified, which is decent. In the US, it's about 1%. American rail runs on diesel.
The green case for rail in the US is...
It's still better than truck, but it's not the slam dunk the headline numbers suggest. Diesel locomotives emit significant CO2 and, critically, particulate matter, especially around rail yards in urban areas, which tend to be in lower-income neighborhoods. There's an environmental justice dimension here that the rail is green. Narrative often skips over.
Like adopting a feral cat. Seems straightforward until you look at the details.
Actually, a very good analogy for rail policy generally.
Let's pivot to the disruptors. You mentioned autonomous trucking earlier, and that seems like it could upend this entire calculus.
This is the thing that keeps rail executives up at night. The rail industry's cost advantage over truck rests substantially on labor efficiency. One train crew of two or three people moves 10,000 plus tons, while one truck driver moves about 25 tons. But if you remove the driver from the truck equation, the math shifts.
How much of trucking's cost is the driver?
Roughly 30 to 40% of the per mile cost of trucking is labor. Autonomous trucks also don't have hours of service restrictions. They can run 22 hours a day with only refueling stops. Aurora, Waymo Via, and a few others are targeting commercial driverless operations on highway lanes by 2028 to 2030.
A truck that never sleeps, with no driver to pay, on routes where rail currently wins on cost.
The break-even distance for rail versus autonomous truck might push out to 800 or 1,000 miles. That eats into a big chunk of rail's intermodal business. But there's a countervailing force, capacity. One double-stack intermodal train carries the equivalent of about 280 trucks. Even with autonomous driving, you can't fit 280 additional trucks onto Interstate 80 without massive congestion.
The highway becomes the bottleneck before the economics flip.
And that's why the intermodal growth story is so important. Containerized rail, double-stack trains moving shipping containers from ports to inland distribution hubs has grown about 40% in the U.S. since 2015. The Alameda Corridor in Los Angeles is the poster child here. 20 miles of rail express line connecting the ports of L.A. and Long Beach to the inland rail yards. It moves about 25% of all U.S. container imports, bypassing 200-plus street-level crossings and cutting truck traffic on I-7-110 by 30%.
20 miles of rail replacing how many truck trips?
And the expansion of the Panama Canal in 2024 and the opening of the port of Lázaro Cárdenas in Mexico in 2025 are creating entirely new rail corridors. Containers from Asia land on the Mexican Pacific coast, get loaded onto trains, and arrive in Chicago or Kansas City without ever touching a U.S. port.
That's a fascinating strategic shift, bypassing West Coast port congestion entirely.
It changes the modal calculus. A shipment of electronics from Shenzhen to Chicago via LA Long Beach Port to Chicago Rail Ramp takes 14 to 18 days door-to-door. All truck from LA to Chicago takes 3 to 4 days, but costs 2.5 times more. The rail option wins for cost-sensitive, time-tolerant cargo, which is most retail goods.
We've got a landscape where rail dominates bulk commodities by default, competes on long-haul containerized freight, and loses on short-haul and time-critical shipments. What about the driver shortage? That seems like a structural advantage for rail.
The American Trucking Associations estimated 80,000 unfilled driver positions in 2025, projected to reach 160,000 by 2030. It's a brutal job, long hours away from home, sedentary, high stress, and the pay hasn't kept pace with the demands. Rail doesn't have this problem to nearly the same degree, but it has its own labor issues.
Crew fatigue and union work rules.
The unions have been fighting PSR implementation tooth and nail because it often means longer trains with the same crew size, tighter schedules, and less recovery time. There have been some high-profile fatigue-related incidents. The Federal Railroad Administration has been pushing for updated hours of service rules, so neither mode has a clean labor story.
On the environmental side, you mentioned carbon pricing as a potential driver of modal shift.
The EU's emissions trading system now covers transport, which effectively puts a price on the carbon advantage rail offers. California's Advanced Clean Fleets rule is pushing towards zero-emission trucks, which are heavier and more expensive than diesel equivalents, at least for now. If carbon pricing spreads, rail's 75% emissions advantage becomes a direct cost advantage, but again, only if the rail network is electrified.
Which in North America, it almost entirely isn't.
1% electrification. The U.S. would need a Marshall Plan scale investment to electrify its freight rail network. The Class I railroads have shown no appetite for it. They're private companies, electrification has a decades-long payback period, and their shareholders want quarterly returns. In Europe, electrification is happening faster because the national networks are publicly owned and the EU is subsidizing the transition.
Let's step back and talk about what actually determines the rail versus truck decision for someone making these calls day to day.
It boils down to three variables: distance, cargo value density, and time sensitivity. If your shipment is over 500 miles, low value per pound, and not time critical, rail is almost always cheaper. If any of those conditions flip, shorter distance, higher value density, tighter delivery window, truck wins.
Give me the value density piece in more detail.
Think about what you're shipping. A ton of coal is worth maybe $50. A ton of iPhones is worth, I don't know, $1 million. The transportation cost as a percentage of total value is negligible for the iPhones. You'll pay for the fastest, most secure mode because inventory carrying cost and obsolescence risk dominate. For the coal, transportation might be 40% of the delivered cost, so you obsess over every cent per ton mile.
That inventory carrying cost is the hidden variable most people don't think about. If your cargo is worth a lot, every day in transit is money.
Let's say you're shipping a container of consumer electronics worth $200,000. At a 10% annual inventory carrying cost, that container is costing you about $55 a day just to exist in transit. Rail adds 2 to 3 days versus truck, so that's $110 to $165 in additional carrying cost. Suddenly, the rail freight savings don't look as compelling.
High-value goods almost always go truck, regardless of distance.
Or air, if it's really high-value and time-critical. But for overland, yes. The other piece is that high-value goods tend to move in smaller, more frequent shipments to closely match demand. Rail wants big, predictable, consistent volumes. Trucking handles variability better.
The infrastructure constraint you mentioned, that rail is often simply unavailable for specific lanes.
This is the part that frustrates shippers the most. Even where rail makes perfect economic sense, the service might not exist, or it might exist, but be so unreliable that you can't build a supply chain around it. The U.S. rail network has been shrinking for a century. Thousands of miles of branch lines have been abandoned. If your facility isn't on a Class I main line or a short line that connects to one, you don't have a rail option.
Short lines being the smaller railroads that feed the Class I networks.
About 600 short line and regional railroads in the U.S., operating roughly 50,000 miles of track, about a third of the total network. They're the capillaries. Without them, the class I arteries don't get fed. And short lines are perpetually undercapitalized, often operating on track that hasn't seen major investment in decades.
You could be a manufacturer 5 miles from a short line that can only handle 10-mile-per-hour speeds and 20-year-old locomotives that break down every other week. That's not a viable logistics option.
That scenario is more common than people think. There's a chicken processor in rural Georgia I read about that's 3 miles from a short line, but the track is so poorly maintained the railroad imposes a 5-mile-per-hour speed restriction for the first 12 miles. The truck option is faster, more reliable, and, when you factor in the transloading and delay risk, not meaningfully more expensive. The rail option exists on paper and nowhere else.
Which creates a fragility in the system that isn't obvious from the outside.
The system works until it doesn't. The 2022 freight rail service crisis, where multiple Class 1 railroads essentially stopped providing reliable service to large swaths of their network, was a wake-up call. The Surface Transportation Board held emergency hearings. Shippers testified about grain rotting in silos, fertilizer not reaching farms during planting season, factory slowdowns due to part shortages. All because the railroads had cut crews and mothballed locomotives too aggressively under PSR.
Some of that freight shifted to truck permanently.
Once you redesign your supply chain around truck, you're not coming back to rail unless there's a compelling reason. The switching costs are real. You've built relationships with trucking companies. You've sited your distribution centers near highways rather than rail spurs. You've adjusted your inventory levels to faster transit times. Modal choice has hysteresis.
There's a Herman word.
It's the right word. The system's state depends on its history, not just current conditions. Even if rail service improves, the shippers who left may not return.
Let's talk about China, because the 50% rail share is so far outside the Western experience.
China is a different category entirely. The state decided rail freight was a strategic priority and funded it accordingly, $1.2 trillion since 2010. They've built dedicated high-speed freight corridors. They've integrated rail terminals into major industrial parks. They've used administrative measures to push freight off highways and onto rail during pollution crises.
It's not a market outcome.
It's an industrial policy outcome. And it works for China's economic structure. Huge volumes of coal and steel moving long distances from interior production regions to coastal manufacturing hubs, then containers moving finished goods back to interior consumption centers. The flows are balanced in a way that American rail flows often aren't.
Empty backhauls being the profitability killer.
If your train goes from Chicago to Los Angeles full of auto parts and comes back empty, you're only making money on half the round trip. The U.S. has persistent trade imbalances that create directional freight imbalances. The West Coast ports import far more than they export, so containers pile up and railroads have to reposition empties. That's pure cost.
How big a drag is that, actually? The empty container problem?
It's enormous. Roughly 20 to 25% of all container moves by rail in the U.S. are empty repositioning. That's thousands of trains a year hauling nothing but air and steel boxes just to get the containers back to where they're needed. The railroads charge for it, obviously. It's built into the rate structure, but it consumes capacity that could be earning revenue. If you could wave a wand and balance U.S. trade flows, you'd instantly increase effective rail capacity by something like 15% without laying a single mile of new track.
That's a staggering inefficiency hiding in plain sight.
It's almost never discussed in the modal shift conversation because you can't solve it with transportation policy. It's a trade policy problem that manifests as a logistics problem.
What's the actionable picture for someone managing logistics? What should they actually do with all this?
First, treat the rail versus truck decision as a function of three variables: distance, value density, and time sensitivity. If you're over 500 miles, under roughly $5 per pound in cargo value, and your delivery window is measured in days, not hours, rail should be on the table.
If any of those doesn't hold, start with truck.
Start with truck, and only consider rail if there's a compelling cost reason. Second, evaluate rail on specific corridors, not as a blanket alternative. Rail makes sense from LA to Chicago. It probably doesn't make sense from Atlanta to Miami. The service quality and transit time vary enormously by lane. Talk to shippers who actually use that corridor, not just the railroad's marketing materials.
The marketing materials will tell you every lane is great.
The marketing materials are aspirational fiction in some cases. Third, watch the regulatory and technology trends. Autonomous trucking could flip the economics within 5 years. If you're making a long-term logistics investment, model what happens when truck driver costs drop by 30%. On the flip side, carbon pricing could make rail's environmental advantage a hard cost advantage, especially in Europe and California.
Electrification is the wild card.
Rail's environmental advantage is real but contingent on electrification. A diesel train is better than a diesel truck per ton mile, but an electric train powered by a clean grid is in a different league entirely. Europe is moving in that direction. The U.S. is not. That divergence will shape modal choice for decades.
The future isn't rail versus truck. It's which kind of rail versus which kind of truck, in which regulatory environment, on which corridors.
The countries that invest in rail electrification and intermodal infrastructure now will have a logistics advantage in the 2030s. China already has it. Europe is trying. The U.S. seems content to let the market sort it out, which means the market will continue to choose trucks for most things and rail for the things only rail can do.
Which brings us to the big open question. Will autonomous trucks kill long-haul rail?
I don't think they kill it, but they compress it. They push rail back into the niches where it's truly irreplaceable. Bulk commodities, the densest intermodal corridors, the longest hauls. The middle ground, the 500 to 1,000 mile container moves, that's where autonomous trucks could eat rail's lunch.
Unless highway congestion becomes the binding constraint.
Which it will on certain corridors. I-80, I-40, I-5. You can't quadruple truck volumes on those highways. At some point, the congestion cost outweighs the driver savings, and rail's capacity advantage reasserts itself. The Alameda Corridor worked because the alternative was gridlock.
The future is messy and corridor-specific, which is honestly the most honest conclusion we could reach.
Logistics is always messier than the consultant's slide deck suggests. The modal split we have today reflects a century of infrastructure decisions, geography, industrial structure, and regulation. It won't change overnight, but it will change.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1970s, a surge in commercial kelp harvesting along the Yukon River Delta inadvertently collapsed the local population of ribbon seals, not because of the kelp removal itself, but because the harvest barge's engine noise disrupted the seals' underwater mating calls, which they produced by inflating a specialized air sac in their throat. The seals abandoned the delta within 3 seasons and never returned.
Right.
The Yukon River has ribbon seals?
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It genuinely helps. Submit your own prompts at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back next week with something else entirely.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.